This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. With the primary under a week away, candidates went under their lights during their televised debates.
If you believe the death penalty is wrong, and I do, then it is not just wrong in the future. It is wrong today as well. And to me, when we have not executed somebody in about 80 years, but then the one time that you would actually get to impose or not impose your value system, you choose to execute, as my two opponents do, it is hard to say with a straight face that you oppose the death penalty as a practical matter.
Steve Marchand making his case to core Democratic voters. In competitive races, the focus was on making sure Tuesday goes well. In the most high-profile race, Kelly Ayotte talked like the general election was already underway.
And this is also another area. Governor Maggie Hassan has not talked about this hostage payment. And I think this is something that's really important in terms of our national security.
Meanwhile, a judge in Stafford County shoots down the state's cap on education funding. It's our weekly news roundup on The Exchange. Give us a call. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or, of course, find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor, Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University, and Paul Steinhauser, political correspondent and anchor for NH1 News. Good morning, all. It's been a busy week for politicians and primaries and a busy one for people who have to scurry around covering them. I want to talk first about the week's televised debates on WMUR and NH1. Why don't we start with the statewide race with the most candidates and perhaps the most suspense, the race for governor. Allie and Paul, you both posed questions in the governor's debates this week. Do you think that the debate shook up these races at all? I guess I'll start with you, Allie.
Yeah, I mean, I think for those of you who watched the WMUR debates on Tuesday, rather, in the GOP debate, you know, we saw Jeanie Forrester and Ted Gatzis, who's the Manchester mayor, really go at it. And I think what has become one of the most widely exchanged or widely covered exchanges this week, Jeanie Forrester has had a controversial proposal to send the National Guard to the southern border of New Hampshire to try to stop the flow of opioids into the state. It's been panned by the other GOP candidates in the race. But on Tuesday, she pointed out that the National Guard has actually been working in New Hampshire on this issue for years, and that two people actually from the National Guard are working in Manchester already. Ted Gatzis has kind of pushed back on that point. And what's come out later is that both of them are sort of right. You know, there are National Guard members working in Manchester. They're analysts behind computers, but they do help on big drug busts in Manchester.
I think we actually have tape of some of that exchange. So why don't we take a listen to this from the MUR Republican debate.
And again, when we talk about the borders, are we going to stop every tourist that comes to the state of New Hampshire to check them to make sure that they're not carrying drugs into this state? How is the National Guard going to actually advocate for that or do it?
Senator Forster.
Yeah. Well, Mayor, I really am surprised that you don't understand or seem to be uninformed that the National Guard is actually working in Manchester now with law enforcement to try to deal with the heroin and opioid crisis in your city. In your city. And in fact, the High Intensity Drug Task Force area shows that along the Mass border is where most of the drugs are coming in. So when I talk about using the National Guard, I say, yes, we should have all the tools in the toolbox using those tools. And quite honestly, I'm surprised that you wouldn't want to use all the tools available as governor to make sure we end this crisis.
Take 30 seconds, Mayor.
Well, thank you very much. We've used every tool in the toolbox here in Manchester.
I think,
Senator, that when you talk about what are we going to do, it's
what
not
are you going to do?
Well, Senator, I know that you're much more respectful in that.
Okay. Manchester Mayor Ted Gatzis, State Senator Jeanie Forrester going at it over drugs and the National Guard. Much more respectful than that. With the primary a couple of days away, you know, respect can be in short supply. Paul, you know, the GOP race feels perhaps more up in the air than the Democratic race for governor, and certainly a much harder-edged tone. Would you agree with that?
I would agree. And here's why I think both of these debates were so important, the NH1 News debate from last week and the WMUR debate this week in the Republican gubernatorial showdown. It basically accentuated storylines we've all been covering for quite some time. Ted Gatzis and Chris Sununu, not a lot of love lost between these two gentlemen. Jeanne Forrester doesn't have a lot of money, can't go up with ads, so she's dropping a lot of bombs. Frank Edelblue trying to tout that he is the most conservative in the race. The three of us here, we've been covering it. We know that. But I think most voters here in New Hampshire are just starting to pay attention in the last week or two. And so that's why these debates are really kind of tuning them into a race that's been going on and been heated for quite some time.
Yeah, seriously, the challenge here is that timing, having a primary second week of September, you know, it's the summer, it's Labor Day, and all of a sudden people realize if they're going to vote, they have 2 weeks to figure out what they're going to do. I think we've had between the two channels something like 9 or 10 debates at this point. So you do have an opportunity to get to know these candidates for the primary. But, you know, the reality is most of them are still largely unknown if you look at the most recent polling data, with the exception of Chris Sununu and Ted Gatzis. Most of them, particularly on the Democratic side, are largely unknown. A few of them have been up with TV ads. I've seen Ted Gatzis. I've seen Chris Sununu. I've seen Mark Connelly and Colin Van Ostern on the Democratic side. So a lot of this really is kind of last-minute decision-making by voters, kind of a gut-level sense of who they like. And it's going to come down to turnout. If these turn out to be low turnout affairs, that's going to have kind of a big impact on it. But it is interesting that in any other election year without this big presidential race and Senate race on top of it, 7 people vying to be the next governor of the state in an open seat would be a really big story, but it's kind of been sandwiched in between all the other stuff going on.
Well, polls show that drugs are the top concern among voters. You know, I will say personally, I have a hard time gleaning if that's going to actually drive any voters to vote in a certain way, or whether it becomes a proxy of, you know, managerial competence in the case of Ted Gatzis, or, you know, tone in the case of Jeanne Forrester. I mean, from talking to voters, any of you, do any of you get the sense that you're talking to voters who are saying, well, you know, I really am going to make my decision based on how they feel they're addressing New Hampshire's drug crisis? Allie?
You know, I think it's an interesting issue because there is such bipartisan support for tackling the opioid crisis. I don't think there's any candidate who would say that's not a priority. So I think it's an issue that may be on voters' minds, but there's not a lot of light and day between the candidates and their proposals for this. Most are pushing spending more money in some area, whether it's prevention or recovery or treatment. And so I think for people looking at the Democratic candidates, They're all talking about spending more money on this issue. It comes down to maybe how are they going to raise that money. That's where they do have differences. You know, Colin Van Ostern and Mark Connelly propose a tobacco tax. Steve Marchand wants to legalize marijuana. And so I think, you know, candidates are mostly in agreement about how they want to deal with this issue. It's how they're going to raise the funding or maybe their leadership style that's really the differentiator for voters.
And on the Democratic side, I mean, that race is, as we've said, particularly one where, according to the polling, none of these fellows are as well known as some of the Republicans are, at least. You know, by that logic, the debates this week for them are earlier in the week on MUR and last night on NH1. This would be a real chance for these guys to make a difference. You know, what feat did these guys try to put forward, and assuming it was their best one, Dean, last night? I mean, if you had to sort of do a quick description of what each guy's going for at this point.
Well, they talked a lot about how to generate sufficient revenue in the state. There was a lot of talk about whether or not to raise the gasoline tax again, whether or not they supported a sales and income tax, all the kind of, you know, traditional measures that we talk about in terms of providing sufficient state revenues. And, you know, one of the few exceptions was Steve Marchand talking about legalizing marijuana. It's sort of become his Maggie Hassan Casino's silver bullet, although he's only talking about something like $30 million. And I think the figure that Maggie Hassan used to use for casinos was about $80 million. So not even all that much. You know, sort of very, very traditional kind of progressive themes. I think the thinking is if it's a low turnout election, it's going to be kind of lean, a little bit progressive. So very active role for government in terms of education and certainly dealing with the opioid crisis. You know, I actually saw both NH1 and the MUR Democratic debates, and, you know, they all had a lot to say, but I don't know, other than sort of voters getting kind of a general reaction to kind of seeing their personalities, seeing how they present themselves, not a huge amount of daylight between them on a lot of issues. It's more sort of a matter of degree. But as you said, you look at the MUR polling on this, and they all have sort of very low kind of identifiability as candidates, which, you know, I think the one disadvantage for Steve Marchand is he's not on TV, whereas Colin Van Ostern and Mark Connolly are both on TV, which I think will help them.
Yeah, you know, I was just going to add, you know, I talked to some voters after the WMUR debate, some Democrats, and the message from them was they're more confused than ever about who they're going to vote for. And I think that, you know, as you mentioned, some of these candidates are up on air. Steve Marchand hasn't been up on air, and I think a lot of voters haven't been paying attention. And so when they tuned in, they saw three candidates with different qualities and just kind of lost the assurity of who they were going to vote for. I've heard a lot of people saying that they're giving Steve Marchand another look. And I don't know if maybe because he's not going up with ads, he won't be able to capitalize on that. But I think another point to make is that I think the Democratic side is even harder to predict because there aren't a lot of contested primaries. You know, on the Republican side, we have pretty much primaries up and down the ballot, which could be a big draw to voters who maybe want to vote in this race or that race, and then they'll end up voting in the governor's race as well. But on the Democratic side, there's really not a lot of competition that's going to turn out Democrats or get them excited about heading to the polls on September 13th.
Paul?
And in fact, Secretary of State Garner yesterday predicting about 86,000 for the Democratic primary next Tuesday, 40,000 less than the Republican, because, yeah, there really is one exciting race near the top of the ticket. I think both debates, though, and Dean, I'll disagree with you just a little bit on this one. I think, you know, obviously they're not as fiery, as contentious as the Republican debates or race, but there was a clear difference in both debates, the MUR earlier in the week and last night on our NH1 News debate, when it came to where the Democratic candidates stand on raising the gas tax, the business profits tax, the tobacco tax, Northern Pass. And there was a contentious moment in our debate as well when Mr. Connolly pushed back against Colin Van Ostern's stance on Medicaid expansion.
Well, why don't we take a listen? I think we've got tape of that from last night's debate. That would be clip number 6 from the NH1 debate last night.
When we extended Medicaid health care coverage to 50,000 people, it was an extraordinary effort. It took a lot of work from a lot of people. I was proud to cast the deciding vote to implement that. That also brought $608 million into our state, and thousands of those people are getting treatment specifically for substance use disorder.
And Mark Connolly had a quick reply on that. That would be 7.
Connolly, all due respect, you said you were deciding vote on Medicaid expansion. Medicaid expansion is important here. It addresses almost 40% of the problem in terms of the people who are addicted. But this was the legislature who did this. You guys, you voted on the contract. So to say you were the deciding vote, I think, is a little bit of an exaggeration.
Okay, so that was Mark Connolly and Colin Van Ostern going back and forth on whether or not Van Ostern was, in fact, the deciding vote to expand Medicaid. This is something you looked at for PolitiFact, Allie, and you rated Van Ostern's claim, if my recollection is correct, mostly false.
Yes.
Why?
I'm just pulling that up now. So we fact-checked this. Generally, when someone says they're the deciding vote, we consider that either they've waffled in the past or they've haven't said how they're going to vote. And then when it comes to their turn and it would be a tie, they cast the deciding vote. Colin Van Ostern has always been an outspoken supporter of Medicaid expansion. And as Mark noted in that clip, this was actually passed by the legislature. It was signed by Governor Maggie Hassan. And what came before the Executive Council was a contract to move this forward with three private companies to start putting these people into the exchange. And that is what Colin and the Executive Council voted on. At the time, it was a 3-2 split. Democrats were in the majority. And this contract wasn't really expected to fail. Both Republicans voted against it. All three Democrats voted for it. And so that's how it ended up getting mostly false.
Van Ostern's logic is essentially this contract was necessary to implement this. So without the contract, these people wouldn't have insurance.
Correct. That's... Yes. And his other claim, you know, is that if he hadn't have voted for this, then it wouldn't have passed, which is true. But, you know, the vote to approve the program had already passed the legislature with bipartisan support. And, you know, he had stated his support ahead of time and was one of the strong supporters of the contract.
I mean, it was interesting. It's interesting to watch the debates. I mean, certainly Van Ostern, he's been involved in politics for a long time as a political operative before he was a candidate. And you know, he's pitching himself quite explicitly as, you know, the next in line kind of continuum of Shaheen, Lynch, Hassan, you know, and, you know, the belief is the establishment forces in the party would prefer him. You say that you believe that this race is very up in the air, and certainly Democrats, if you're out there and favor any of these guys, certainly call us up at 1-800-892-6477. You know, Paul, do you see this as up in the air, this race?
I do. I think you could say Colin Van Ostrand is the slight favorite, not because of name recognition, but because of organization. He's probably got the stronger campaign, and he's got more support from some of the unions and organizations like Planned Parenthood that actually do a good job in getting the vote out. And that's going to be crucial in a low turnout primary next Tuesday. So that's why I'll give him the slight upper hand. But no, none of these candidates is very well known at all. And that exchange between Connolly and Van Ostrand, I guess that was probably about as fiery as you can get in the Democratic race.
Fiery debate,
yeah, it doesn't really pale to the Republicans, but we'll take what we can get, right?
Right. I think Paul's basically right when, you know, in lieu of any useful polling data on this race, if you look at the other traditional indicators of viability, you know, the amount of money raised, he's raised a ton of money, he's got a strong organization, he's got endorsements from a lot of the kind of big players. And Josh, I like your depiction of kind of the next in line of succession. I think there is an element to that. But I think overall, getting back to these two debates that we watched with them, I agree more with Ali in the sense that I think coming away from it, the average Democratic voter at all, you know, it's going to end up being more sort of kind of stylistic and who you get a better vibe from. I think some of these detailed discussions about, you know, business profits tax, business enterprise tax, gas tax, et cetera, kind of gets lost on people. But Paul is right. There were some of those differences in the debate.
Well, do you think that Steve Marchand's efforts to kind of leverage the Sanders vote, such as it is, are going to bear any fruit? Senator Sanders came to Warner over the weekend, and Steve Marchand was there with him, certainly the only Democrat running for governor there. You know, you could argue that Steve Marchand might not be sort of out of central casting to be a Sanders guy, but, you know, he made the pitch in one of the debates that, you know, he's viewing this as, you know, what Wayne Gretzky apparently once said about hockey, is you need to skate to where the puck is going rather than where it's been. Any sense whether he's really gaining traction on that front?
I think that, as we were just talking about, people don't really know who these candidates are. Some of the issues might be, you know, the BPT, the BET might not really resonate with voters. I think the names Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders do resonate with voters. I mean, for the last, year, they've been bombarded with messages from Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. It was a very visceral race here in the state. And so I don't think it's a bad strategy for him to align with Bernie Sanders. I mean, that's one area where he breaks with the other two candidates.
Well, that was a question that was put well during the NH1 debate, which was kind of like, you have to campaign with one of them, you know, who's it going to be? And Marchand was the only person who affirmatively came out and said Sanders.
And here's why he's been trying to tout himself as the biggest progressive in this race, which is interesting because just 2 years ago, he was chairman of the No Labels or state director of No Labels, which is the middle of the road group here in the state and nationally. It's going to be a low turnout primary, as we've said. It's probably going to trend left. So everybody's trying to say they're the biggest progressive in the race. Marchand is trying to do that. I think the other two guys definitely disagree with that, but Marchand's been very vocal about that.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, too, just to note, I just went back through his Twitter account to kind of check and see how long this Bernie fervor has been going on. And, you know, I think it may be popping up more now than it had, you know, in the past.
Yeah, for Marchand, yeah, he's been getting a lot of flack on Twitter from people who are bringing up the No Labels past and saying he's a fake progressive. And that's something he's going to have to deal with.
And certainly in a primary, you know, there's a lot of accusations of fakery that come out as the time comes near to vote. You know, we're going to turn to some other races after the break. But do call us. Let us know how you're going to vote come Tuesday. If you're going to vote in the primaries, call us at 1-800-892-6477. We'll also accept your email at exchange@nhpr.org, or you can tweet at us or post something on Facebook. We'll be back after a short break. New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. email at exchange@npr.org or via Facebook or Twitter. We're joined today by Paul Steinhauser, NH1, Ali Morris, Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. And why don't we take a call? We have a call. Kat is on the line from Hollis. Good day, Kat.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call in. Actually, I'm running for office myself for state rep in Hollis and a couple of other towns. But I've met.
Do you have a primary?
No, I don't. but I'm voting in the primary. And I've met Steve Marchant and the other candidates on the trail. And I'm supporting Steve Marchant. And the reason I am is because I think, you know, when you talk about progressive and the road that we've been traveling and Bernie supporters and all that, I think there's a change going on in the country in terms of how we look at politics and politicians and the lack of faith that we have in folks. And we need to be able to support people who rise up in the public servant role as opposed to a career politician. And I think that Steve fills that role. He's young, he's got a lot of ideas, and he's also researched all of the things that are facing the state because he's, you know, he's a Granite Stater. And he just has really thorough answers, and he talks about virtuous cycles.
Okay,
so when
Kat,
I listen to him, I think he's systemic in the way he looks at how to take us to the future, and I think that that's something we really need. Yep.
Okay, you dig Steve Marchant. Clear. Did you look at any of the other candidates seriously?
I have, actually, and I like Mark Conley for his integrity. I've read his book, and I've seen Colin on the Stump several times. But I just think in terms of depth and approaches and a real deep understanding of what's going on in the state and where we need to go, he's got more vision. He's got more vision, in my opinion.
All right. Thanks, Kat, for calling. If you want to weigh in, call us on the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Okay, somebody who's definitely a Steve Marchant supporter there. Why don't we move to the Senate race and the Senate debate for a minute. I was a panelist on that one on MUR earlier in the week, and before the debate, Jim Rubins promised he'd be going after Senator Ayotte hard, and he did. Why don't we take a listen to some of what Jim Rubins, former state senator from Aetna, had to say about incumbent Republican Kelly Ayotte.
Bipartisan capitulation doesn't work. She's got an F from Conservative Review. She's got a 27. She votes like Annie Custer, a liberal Democrat in the second CD.
All right. That was the short version. Jim Rubins on WMUR this week. You know, from talking to Republicans, Paul, are you hearing any Republicans in any number who, you know, buy that argument from Jim Rubins?
Not so much. I don't think Jim Rubins is the conservative alternative that a lot of conservatives in the state were hoping for to go up against Kelly Ayotte. I think he was the only one who actually ran. In both the MUR debate this week and in our NH1 News debate last week, Jim Rubins threw everything he could, the kitchen sink, you name any analogy, whatever. He threw it all at Kelly Ayotte. What I thought was interesting, in both debates, it was like you were watching two different debates. Rubins going after Ayotte. Ayotte going after Hassan. I mean, she spent almost all of her time in both the debates not defending herself to Rubens, but actually taking it to Maggie Hassan, who's not there yet. We'll see those debates later in the general election. And it's just a fascinating component.
Well, it was interesting. As a panelist in the MUR debate, I was seated at a table. They're a far distance away in the studio. There's a camera next to the table where the panelists were sitting. And Kelly Ayotte, obviously she's had a lot of media training and she's a, you know, seasoned politician at this point. She's looking directly into the camera. Jim Rubins is standing next to her. She barely acknowledges him. And, you know, but she did get a chance to sort of test out some of the lines of argument she's going to be making against Maggie Hassan, both on the attack and then also on some of the issues where it could be sensitive for her. Why don't we hear what she had to say about her bipartisan record in the Senate, which is something she's talking a great deal about these days.
Let me go back to my time as Attorney General. First appointed by a Republican governor, twice reappointed by a Democrat governor, and I worked across the aisle then on getting things done to keep the people of New Hampshire safe. This is part of my DNA. It's work that I've done in the Senate, and I've been able to get results, whether it's the heroin legislation, fighting for better care for our veterans, suspending the medical device tax, stopping internet taxes that are coming that'll hurt our state. So I know that we have to work together to get things done, and it actually goes back to my time as Attorney General.
Okay, that's Kelly Ayotte on MUR this week, making the case that for her, bipartisanship is kind of bred in the bone. You know, Democrats obviously are you know, trying to pick at that, and they point specifically to votes she took early in her tenure in the Senate. And, you know, recall she was elected in 2010. She, you know, it was a tough primary, tougher than people expected, against conservative Ovid LaMontagne. You know, it was endorsed by Sarah Palin. It was the Tea Party era. You know, her voting record when she got down to Washington was pretty conservative. The last few years, she can lay claim to the fact that she does have a more bipartisan record than most, but Democrats want voters to really scrutinize the early years. I mean, what did you make of Ayotte on this? She didn't really answer the question, which was one I posed, which was, how do you square your early record with your later record and convince people that this isn't simply about a coming election?
Well, you know, it's been clear since she announced her reelection bid that the you know, the strategy that we heard in that clip is exactly the one she's going to pursue to try to win over independents, to kind of position herself as someone who, you know, it's in her interest to kind of put the presidential race aside to some extent because of all the complications for her of having Trump as the nominee. So a lot of times these statewide races are more about what you do for New Hampshire. I thought it was striking that she said that this bipartisan approach is in her DNA. That's a pretty strong statement, not likely to enthuse a lot of conservatives. But for better or for worse, that's kind of where she has set her strategy. There's not a lot to be gained by mixing it up too much with Jim Rubin's. She is focused on the general election, no doubt, and going after Governor Hassan. And yeah, I think it is a way for her to test some of these initial themes. So I was not surprised by anything she said. We knew this was the strategy she was going to use. I think in 2010, she kind of did what she needed to do to sort of to make that jump to the U.S. Senate. But this seems to me kind of more in line of how we've thought of her as a politician for some time now. And, you know, it's perfectly fair game for Democrats to try to get people to focus on the conservative stuff. She's going to spend a lot of time pushing back on that.
So, Ali, in your rounds, I mean, are you hearing any dissatisfaction? I mean, during the presidential primary, I mean, you could go to events and there'd be staunch conservatives there saying, you know, essentially like Ayotte needs to go. And that was not an uncommon thing to hear, particularly if you were at, you know, a Trump event or Ted Cruz event or talking to real like hardcore conservatives. You know, perhaps it's the reality of like the tribal nature of our politics. As we get closer to an election, a little bit of that fades away, and the alternative of Maggie Hassan seems a bit more ominous to Republicans. I mean, are you hearing much dissatisfaction with Senator Ayotte from conservatives these days?
I mean, I think Rubin's did air some of that dissatisfaction, and I do think it exists. I mean, I think he poked her in a lot of places where conservatives have been unhappy. One of them, you know, she was one of the first Republicans to come out for the EPA's Clean Power Plan, which, you know, angered a lot of Republicans here. It turned AFP off, you know, who's a big spender here in the state.
The Gang of Eight.
Exactly. He went after her support for the Gang of Eight bill, you know, which was that compromise that would have created a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. So I think he did, you know, point to some areas where conservatives have been unhappy. I think what's kind of masking some of this now is Donald Trump. You know, a lot of people say that he's a negative for Kelly Ayotte, but I think in some ways he's really drawn distraction from this race and from other races down ticket. There is still so much focus on the presidential race and, you know, do Republicans want to back him? What are they going to do in the presidential contest? That I think it has taken some of the dismay with Kelly Ayotte away, just because, you know, they see her as a true conservative who could defeat Hassan, whereas at the top of the ticket, there is some waffling.
Paul?
And I'm glad you brought up Trump, because in both the MUR and the NH1 News debates, Rubin's criticized Ayotte for not fully embracing Donald Trump, as we all know she has not. And we know why he's doing that. But I don't think it's working. Yes, there are conservatives who are not very happy at all with Kelly Ayotte. Jim Rubin's is not their guy. They were hoping for some other names in the state who decided not to run. And on primary day, I don't think it's going to be a race that we're going to be thinking is a nail biter.
Probably not. So why don't we sort of move down the list of some of the other debates? One race that, you know, has not gotten a great deal of attention is the second congressional district primary between Jack Flanagan and Jim Lawrence. Jack Flanagan, current state rep; Jim Lawrence, former state rep and former candidate who ran back in 2014. The second congressional district, you know, is increasingly a tough climb for Republicans, particularly in a presidential year. I think you have to look back to 1988 when a Republican has won under those circumstances. What do these guys offer voters in the debates this week? Dean?
Well, you know, it's interesting, as you mentioned, of the five or so primaries that we're having, this is probably the one that's getting the least amount of attention. We know Annie Custer who's already been reelected, once has a pretty decent war chest, and I'm sure will try to paint whoever the nominee is as an extremist, much in the way they did with Marilinda Garcia 2 years ago. Jack Flanagan, obviously former House Majority Leader, kind of a sort of a more traditional Republican / conservative approach coming out of the state legislature. Jim Lawrence in the debate, I believe, did hit him on ultimately supporting Medicaid expansion. Lawrence has run kind of more as an outsider. He kind of got into the race a little bit late last time, lost to Marilinda Garcia, but he got kind of good buzz out of that, and I think that sort of encouraged him and others to get him in the race this time around. He's a businessman, former rep. He's a veteran. Using that as well. So it's just really hard to know at this point. I mean, Lawrence seems to have a little bit more of kind of the outsider energy, if that's important in the primary. But Flanagan, for people who follow Republican politics, he's reasonably well known. But in comparison to the other primaries, just not getting a lot of airtime.
So, Paul, what do you make of these guys?
I think in both debates, the NH1 debate and the MUR debate, they argued over – they disagree on some issues, no doubt about that, on how to save Social Security, on Medicaid expansion in the state. Northern Pass, another place where these two guys definitely don't agree. But at the end of the day, I think Lawrence is probably considered the favorite in this race. And of course, he will make history. He'll become the first African-American congressional nominee if he wins here in New Hampshire.
That's true.
Well, I think something – I mean, we talked about this with the governor's candidates. Polls show that voters don't really know who these guys are. The last time I checked, both of them have less than $100,000 cash on hand. And, we talk about so much outside money flowing in for the U.S. Senate race. There really hasn't been much spent on this CD. So
zero.
Yeah. So, I'm not sure how many people outside New Hampshire really see this as a winnable district for Republicans.
Well, I think, people, the national political enterprises, for lack of a better word, they make sort of, hard-headed decisions about these things. And, Custer is a good fundraiser. She hasn't done anything to totally alienate voters of her district. I think it's a tough one. If you were sitting outside New Hampshire to say, where are we going to spend our money where it's likely to have an impact, that's probably not a race.
It's true. The district really has changed. I mean, I've lived in the district for over 20 years now, and just remembering back to when Charlie Bass was the representative of Congress, even watching him kind of shift his position on a variety of issues as the complexion of the district changed. And, now you have Keene, you have the Upper Valley, you have Concord. This is very difficult for Republicans if they don't pull a lot from other areas to win the seat.
Yeah, if they couldn't beat her, if Republicans couldn't beat her in 2014 with a much-touted Marilinda Garcia in a very favorable Republican year, it's going to be really hard this year.
I will say that, there was a poll that came out, the WMUR Granite State poll, I think at the end of August, that showed it was a very close race, that Custer's lead over either of these two candidates had shrunk to single digits. And I think there's something to be said. I mean, her unfavorables have been, high. Her favorables haven't been so great. So I do think that, there isn't a lot of maybe energy in the district for
the issue with that poll, though, is, it was identical. I think each of them was about 5 points behind her. So it had the feel of kind of like Annie Custer against kind of generic Republican candidate. Right. So it's kind of a measure of general Republican dissatisfaction. But it's not clear that either candidate can kind of expand on that initial level of support.
And also, Custer really hasn't done much campaigning yet. She's waiting for the primary to get over, so she really hasn't been out there talking to voters yet. It'll be a different story after Tuesday.
This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange at nhpr.org or Facebook or find us on Twitter. Now, a debate tonight that's going to be on MUR, which I think actually has the potential to really have an effect on this race, is the first congressional district primary between incumbent Frank Ginta and Rich Ashew. And, these guys are well known to each other. They ran against each other back in 2010. From talking to voters in the district, where do you, this is a tight race. Would you agree, Allie?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you drive around Manchester, there's a lot of campaign signs out. You see a lot of Frank Ginta signs. You do see a lot of Ashew signs. And I think this is one that a lot of people are looking at as kind of a deciding factor on Frank Ginta and whether he can weather this storm around his FEC complaints and his funding. I think, you know, if he can get through the primary, that would maybe put to rest a lot of these issues that he's been grappling with. Mind you, he would have to face Carol Shea Porter, who has been one of his strongest critics on this issue in the past. But I think the primary will really be a test to see, do voters care about this issue, and is it something that they're willing to forgive him for?
You know, they've debated once so far at the NH1 debate last week. It was extremely contentious. I thought I was going to have to get in between these two guys and break it up. That's why I think tonight's debate is going to be pretty darn interesting as well. Rich Ashew, I guess you could say, has finally woken up. He's such a gentleman. He's such a nice guy. And he was being a little too kind in this debate, in this race. That has changed in the last 2 weeks. The debate last week, he was extremely aggressive. He's up with a negative ad attacking or at least spotlighting Ginta's campaign contribution controversy. Is it too little too late, as some pundits say? Maybe, but also look at it the other way. Most voters have not been paying a lick of attention until really last week or this week. So I think maybe it may not be too little too late.
That is true. I watched that debate as well, and that was the debate where Ginta kept asking Ashew if he's a registered lobbyist, and he got very defensive, and he wouldn't answer the question. It was just a real unforced error. You know, I've talked to, you know, anecdotally with a lot of people who want to vote in their primary, and they don't understand why Ashew hasn't put Ginta away at this point. He's been very tenacious. He's just kind of sort of full steam ahead talking about what he's doing for his district. But I think Paul has a point there. You know, a lot of people aren't paying attention. And so I think this will be close. But I think some people are surprised that given the way the party abandoned Ginta back when this FEC stuff broke, he's still hanging in there.
But I mean, on the issues, are there any, I mean, you know, is there much light between these guys on the issues, or is this a referendum on, like, is it bad to take an improper contribution from your parents or be a lobbyist and, you know, just whatever?
It's funny. I mean, that was sort of that NH1 debate, which is sort of the most recent data point. You know, a lot of Ginta's argument was about, you know, Ashew is kind of an establishment insider lobbyist. And a lot of Ashew's argument was that Ginta, you know, in addition to the FEC stuff, which he probably didn't hit him as hard as he could have, was simply that he hasn't really accomplished anything. He has nothing to show for his record. So not a lot of policy discussion so much in that debate.
Yeah, you're right. They were pretty close to the policy. The other big flashpoint, and we'll see if it comes up again tonight, was Ashew really took it to Ginta over the bipartisan congressional task force, which Ginta and Annie Custer co-founded. And he basically said that you're grandstanding. And Ginta pushed back hard. And again, it's a touchy issue. Of course, the drug crisis in the state affects so many people. We'll see if they continue. But the big difference here is the first congressional district, regardless of who wins this primary on Tuesday, is going to be going up against Carol Shea Porter. This is one of the most closely watched congressional districts in the country. This is a swing district. It's an early barometer because the polls close early. This race is going to get a ton of money, a ton of national attention, and the three of us and Dean, you as well, will be covering it.
It's true. It does. And, you know, I'm not, you know, we'll see if the world is ready for, you know, sort of part four of, you know, Ginta Shea Porter or whether it's Ashew Shea Porter. But either way, it will be a competitive race. Let us know what races you think are going to be competitive and give us a call at 1-800-892-6477 or email us on The Exchange or on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be back after a short break where we're going to talk about Governor Hassan's drug plan, what she says she will do if she's elected to the U.S. Senate, among other things. Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Tell us what you think about the coming primaries. If you're going to participate, if you're going to sit it out, we have an email in from Nathan in Cornish, and he says, I have no information on the challengers, and I don't think, and I have no reason to think the incumbents are up to snuff, talking about state rep races, some of the down ticket races. So I know I'll be voting for the winners in November, so why bother? So that's from Nathan in Cornish. A lot of unknowns. You know, that's one thing that's interesting about the primary, particularly you get down lower, is that, you know, the primary day comes and goes, and it's like, okay, you know, who's there? you know, as far as some of those down-ticket races, you know, there was some news yesterday, a state Senate candidate, is it District 17?
16.
Don Winterton of Manchester or Florida, depending on he lived there, and there's a seven-year residency requirement. Secretary of State Bill Gardner said that he didn't believe he was eligible. Mr. Winterton had stepped aside, and you know that's a race that's a seat held by Republicans now. David Booten's retirement, and the fact that with Winterton was the choice of a lot of more establishment Republicans. You know, Ali, you know the state house. What do you think Republicans make of Mr. Winterton's exodus? So this is something that's a disappointment to people who want to hold that seat.
I think it is a disappointment. I think what strikes me most is this is sort of shocking to me that it's coming 4 days before the primary. I mean, I think part of this is Mr. Winterton has said he was not aware that this was a problem ahead of time. And so I think that just speaks to, are people really paying much attention to what, you know, we have so many legislators. Are people really paying attention to what you need to do to qualify to be one of those legislators? And so I think... I think that Republicans may have kind of dropped the ball on this, not vetting their candidates ahead of time before, fielding them in these races. And you just wonder, with 400 state rep seats, with a two-year residency requirement, you know, are all these people meeting the mark? And this came out of a campaign complaint. And, you know, if these aren't raised on a regular basis, who is vetting these people to make sure that they're actually able to run?
It's a big development. It's going to be pretty close in the state Senate battle. Democrats think they can retake the chamber. Winterton was, considered one of the favorites in this race. This is a swing district. Democrats think they can win it back. And without Winterton in the race, maybe they have a slightly better.
I think the other candidate, State Rep. Joe Duart, who's was elected in 2010. I believe he served in the Navy. Very conservative. Certainly somebody that the Democrats believe they have a better chance of beating than Mr. Winterton. So I guess we'll see what happens. But there are going to be a lot of people having to get to know the candidates in that race.
Exactly, yeah. And this was the seat held by Dave Booten, who, carved a name for himself in the Senate as someone who was willing to work with the other side. Wasn't moderate, but, he was willing to break with his party on major issues. And so I think we see the Republican candidate coming forward as a big break from the way that he took on the state Senate.
What do you guys think? Is it ironic that, it's a seven-year requirement, resident requirement to run for the state Senate, but Scott Brown can move to New Hampshire and declare residency in December 2013 and just 5 months later run for the U.S. Senate here in New Hampshire, but can't do it in the state Senate?
No, you can't. And this is something that, has come up in state Senate races before, and I do think Ali makes a good point that you could argue that it's a sort of a basic due diligence if you're gonna sign up for one of these things to at least make sure that you're qualified. But why don't we move back to drugs for a moment? Governor Hassan rolled out the plan. She said that the priority she says she would have should she win election to the U.S. Senate. She did this at a roundtable at Nashville Community College. I was there. It was pretty low key, as her policy roles have tended to be, roundtable of people involved in drug efforts or people from law enforcement, from the addiction recovery communities, and what she laid out wasn't terribly new. I mean, it was sort of comprehensive and sort of a piece with stuff that's been going on at the state house. I mean, the main thing was federal money. I mean, you wrote about this, Ali. I mean, the main thing was federal money.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think most of this plan, obviously, Governor Hassan has been dealing with this for the past 2 years. At the state of New Hampshire, this has been a major issue here. And a lot of the legislative efforts have been to try to boost funding for this. And she's, been signing a lot of this legislation into law. Most of this plan was kind of based on what New Hampshire has done and applying it to the federal level. One of those is a prescription drug monitoring program, which allows doctors to track what types of prescriptions their patients are getting so that they can prevent doctor shopping and having people going around and kind of getting as many opioid prescriptions as they can. She proposes making that mandatory nationwide.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting as a requirement for receiving a DEA license. And
right.
This is obviously always touchy terrain in terms of the medical community doesn't want mandates that they believe gets involved with their specific practices. Mm-hmm. But that I thought that was interesting, and particularly since New Hampshire, I mean, now, at this roundtable, people were talking about how we may have the toughest prescription drug monitoring program in the nation. This is what State Rep. Cindy Rosenwald was talking about. It's only been in place for 2 years, and we were I believe, the 48th state to actually get one of these
right.
things off the ground.
Well, and we just made it mandatory this year, and I believe it hasn't even taken effect yet because they're upgrading the technology. They had to spend some money doing that. So, yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, I think as we've seen, there have been a lot of negative ads attacking Governor Hassan from outside groups accusing her of mismanaging this crisis. You know, she's called them disgusting, and there's been a real outcry in the community about politicizing this issue. But, you know, as we've talked about, opioids and drug abuse are a major issue on voters' minds this year, and I think they want to be able to see, you know, a political leader who has a grasp of this issue and who will be able to make, you know, positive change.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised that this was really one of the sort of first big proposals she puts forward as a potential senator, because it has been such a contentious issue. We have had those outside groups running ads against her for mishandling the crisis. I think anybody in the state who tries to watch a YouTube video is going to see one of those ads pretty much every time they log in. You know, this issue about politicization, I've never really quite followed, because, you know, to the extent that the government is in charge of sort of responding to this crisis, that by its very nature is a political solution. So you have to talk about this stuff in an election. And so, you know, you can argue about whether or not the outside group ads are fair. But it has to be part of the political discourse. It's such a big issue here in the state. And I'm not surprised to kind of see her initial plan sort of take what she's been doing here and try to put it out at the federal level. That does get a little more complicated because you're dealing with individual states who may be doing their own thing as well.
I thought the funding was the most interesting thing for me when we covered this story yesterday. As you mentioned, Josh, she did tout that funding is so crucial and we have to get the funding here to New Hampshire. This comes as Senator Kelly-Ayotte, you know, she was the author and really pushed for the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act. That's now law. The president signed it. But one of the big arguments that Democrats criticize her for is, where's the money? Where's the funding? Interesting that Hassan brought that up yesterday and highlighted it.
I mean, I also found that detail interesting. And, you know, she mentioned that, you know, Senator Jeanne Shaheen had sponsored a bill last year to, I think it was $600 million in emergency funding. And what Governor Hassan said yesterday was, you know, if I get down there, getting emergency funding is going to be my first priority. And so,
What she didn't say was that Senator Ayotte also supported Shaheen's amendment.
Yes.
Forgot to mention that.
So why don't we go to the phones? We have a call from Mac in Rochester. Good morning, Mac.
Good morning. How are you today?
Well, how are you? What's on your mind?
Well, I've been watching the election process, first the Republican presidential election, where Trump took on a large field and with adroit use of sharp elbows dominated the media coverage and consequently wound up, among other reasons, as the Republican opponent in the coming presidential election. And you're seeing some of that in the debates on WMUR and so forth between the Republican candidates for Senate and House. And one of the things that struck me is that some of the criticism of our incumbent Republicans is that it doesn't reflect the fact that the job that they're doing comes with many challenges that are, if they are true to the Constitution and servants of its dictates, limits what they can do. You can't accuse a candidate of not doing anything when he's done everything within the law and the Constitution that's possible, and the other house doesn't follow through or the president vetoes it.
Well, so Mac, do you think that are you supportive of the our incumbents, particularly? I guess I'm assuming since you're talking Republican, are you a Republican?
I am a Republican.
So
born on February 12th, as it turns out.
Okay. Well, so are you? You know, who are you going to vote for in the first congressional district primary between Frank Ginter and Rich Ashew?
I'll vote for Frank. Frank has done a fantastic job supporting citizens of the seacoast against an overreach by the EPA on water treatment plants and so forth. Probably saved us $150 million in taxes and so forth.
So this whole business with the campaign finance, does that mean anything to you? Do you care?
Well, the whole point of campaign finance disclosure was to find out if we were getting outside sources of income that had purposes that were beyond the understanding of the electorate. That was the whole point of it. And it's hardly surprising that Frank's parents, if that is indeed the case, are far, far afield from where Frank is thinking. That it's a distinction without a difference in this case, I think. And I think it's a kerfuffle and a teacup.
Okay. Thank you, Mac. All right. A kerfuffle and a teacup, says Mac, on Frank and his FEC violations. We'll see what voters make of that. You know, Mac made the point that incumbents often get a bad rap because of the intractable nature of our political process by design, as much as politically. Is that a sentiment you run into much, Dean?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You look at kind of the approval ratings for Congress as a whole. They're always very low, somewhere in the, you know, mid-teens and a good day. But at the same time, you actually find that incumbents get reelected at very high rates. It's something like 93% in the House and something like 83-85% in the Senate. Senate races are a little bit more competitive because they're statewide and they're higher profile and there's typically more money involved. So, you know, in political science, we typically think about incumbents having all these kind of institutional advantages, the franking privilege, the staff, the high visibility, et cetera. So I think the institution gets a bad rap as being kind of intractable. But there is this dichotomy where you find that most representatives get reelected. And I saw some calculation. It might have been the Cook Political Report. I'm not sure. Or maybe 538, one of those, where they said there's only something like, with, you know, all the seats are up in the House of Representatives. There are only about 35 or 36 that are really in play. So, yeah.
Well, one thing that I found interesting, and then this year in which we've had such, you know, you could certainly see in the presidential primary here in New Hampshire, this, you know, thirst for the outsider, kind of a, you know, what at the time sort of a throw the bums out sort of mentality, you know, we're not seeing it manifest itself, or at least we're seeing incumbents remain. I mean, you look across the country at congressional primaries that have taken place, and, you know, there's not much indication that the outsider candidates are having a big year.
No, absolutely true. It has not spilled down to the local level. You're right. All around the country, there were, you know, a number of states had primaries recently, and, you know, John McCain's a good example for example in Arizona won quite easily. Marco Rubio won down in Florida. A number of other races as well.
Allie?
Well, I think challengers have a particularly tough struggle. I mean, it's not enough to have anger to sort of get elected. I think the challenges for people who are going up against an incumbent is they have to first show why the incumbent needs to be fired, you know, why they've done a bad job, and then tell voters why they would be better and really introduce themselves. So I think that, you know, where incumbents just have to tout, you know, why they're doing a good job and deserve another term, the challengers really have to show why the other needs to be fired and then also put their own qualities on display. So I think that's kind of a tougher job in many cases.
All right, a comment from Facebook from Brendan. He is appalled by what he describes as the ridiculous amount of money being spent on the U.S. Senate and other races. He says NHPR has reported $100 million is being spent on the U.S. Senate race, that number being doubled before the end. Imagine what the state could do if it were spent on New Hampshire's actual needs of bridges, drug treatment, addiction, education. Good point, but that's not the world we live in.
No, plus also that's not public, but it's not taxpayer money. I mean, that would be outrageous if it was, but no, these are money raised by outside groups, by state national parties. So, but yes, New Hampshire, this battle is going to be probably the most expensive, most negative, most high-profile U.S. Senate race in the country.
I mean, and, you know, by a lot of outside indications, it's like, you know, the most competitive and increasingly looks that way. And you think about all the money that was spent, Gene Sheen, Scott Brown, I think that came in, I don't know, $65-70 million. Mm-hmm. And we're already past that. And, you know, like it or not, we still got weeks to go before the general. So this is going to be a lot of ads.
It's two cycles in a row. New Hampshire has the marquee race in the U.S. battle for the Senate, the race that could decide whether Democrats or Republicans control it. So I guess for political reporters, we are blessed.
That's one way to look at it.
But one way.
Definitely be busy. Definitely busy. And so, you know, next week, obviously, the voters head to the polls Tuesday. You know, Allie, where are you going to be roaming around on primary night, or where are you likely to be most focused?
I will be most focused on the governor's race. You know, I think that people are anxious to see what the matchup is going to be there. You know, in most of the other races we've talked about, we know one side of the equation. You know, we know most of the Democrats who are going to be running against whoever emerges from the primary. But that's not the case in the governor's race. You know, we have seven candidates. And so I will be really focused on figuring out who is coming out of each of those races and what the general election will look like.
So, Paul, what do you think? Do you think the ill humor that has visited the Republican gubernatorial race is just steady on through Tuesday?
Yeah, there's going to be no let up. It's only going to get accentuated. We'll probably see more contrast ads, as they call them, in the next few days. It's going to stay bitter straight through the end. And I agree with Ali that both the gubernatorial races are going to be intriguing. I also will put in there the ASHU Ginter races, another one that I think everybody's going to be keeping their eyes on.
Yeah, those are the three I think that people will be watching. And then the Republicans are having Chris Christie in the next morning as the
It is the next morning at the
Bedford Village Inn, I think, with as the unity speaker. Democrats are not bringing anybody in.
I mean, it has been a while since the unity breakfast, required as much unity building as this one may, just given the sheer volume of candidates and the strong feelings in the governor's race and certainly in the first CD.
We'll all be there at the Bedford Village Inn Wednesday morning, 8:30. I think we're going to enjoy that one.
All right. Hope that prediction's true, Paul. Thank you for joining us. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Josh Rogers. Have a good weekend. I want to thank our guests, Ali Morris of the Concord Monitor, Paul Steinhauser, NH1, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Have a good one.